Hi, I'm Wayne Jones. Welcome to Editing Writing. This is episode 44, Writing Fiction About Grief, part 2. This is a continuation of the previous episode of Editing Writing, though you can easily listen to each of them on their own. I think they stand sort of separate, and if you didn't have the inclination to listen to both, that should be fine. What I've basically done is that I've took a couple of excerpts from a novel I published in 2012 and analyzed an excerpt of that novel, so as to demonstrate some of the techniques of literary fiction. In case you don't listen to the previous episode, I'll repeat the same caveat. I'm certainly not holding my novel up as a model of literary fiction writing, but rather as an example. Whatever my faults and abilities in writing fiction, I was, though, always very conscious of writing something that didn't just, quote unquote, tell a story, but that paid very close attention to the words I was using. In fact, I may devote a future episode to exactly what literary fiction is, with examples from other writers that might illustrate the point more clearly. Now, literary fiction, I think the term is sometimes used to mean anything other than what is called genre fiction, that is fantasy novels, mystery novels, sci-fi, that kind of thing. Literary fiction is often used as something that's not a specific genre, so to speak. But the term has a slight tinge of hoity-toity about it, just like the word hoity-toity itself. So it would be good to clarify a few things. And as I say, maybe in a future episode, I will try to do so. For now, though, what I plan to do is read an excerpt from my novel, which is about a man who is not adjusting very well to the sudden death of his wife. So in the previous episode, what I described and analyzed was his wife's experience of being hit and killed by an SUV while she was on her way to the airport. And in this episode, I'm looking at the other side. So I'm looking at the view from the SUV driver, and we'll just contrast those. So what I'll do, same thing, I'll read the passage first right through, and then go back and comment on some of the choices I made to keep it literary, so to speak. So here goes. Here's the excerpt, uninterrupted. George was driving his brand new SUV, a dark Toreador red 2000 Ford Expedition, which he and his wife had paid cash for the previous month. Driving it through the maze of the Big Dig construction area, looking for the exit which he thought he remembered always being at just the next turn. He was distracted. He and his wife had argued the night before, originally about sex, she wanted more, but devolving over the course of an hour into petty comments about real and embellished incidents, that thing about her blouse being too sheer, his habit of leaving pizza crusts on the coffee table. She raced through her morning rituals without saying a word to him, easing the front door shut behind her as she left, so that for a minute or two, as he lay in bed, George thought she was still in the house. But then silence, and they began to haul himself through his own rituals. He cut himself shaving, and that little cut, a dark red fleck at the bottom of his chin, was still there as he meandered through the north end of Boston, looking for a way back home. He looked right, looked straight ahead, and hit the brakes to avoid a cab which had cut in front of him, blew the horn, swerved, and then took a ramp, heading the wrong way. He wasn't on the ramp for more than a couple of seconds when he saw the car coming right at him. In a rush of confused self-righteousness, continuing the pattern of a day in which he was always the person being wronged, he blew his horn, trying to get her out of the way. But it was all too late for him to turn away, too late for her to avoid the hit. And in a panic, he inadvertently hit the accelerator, surging ahead, his left headlight plowing through the driver's door window, into her, And when things had stopped, when he could feel his vehicle no longer moving, he looked up and all he could see was a stretch of the I-93. It was puzzling until he realized that he was on top of the car. The damage to his left fender looked pretty bad, and the damage to the car looked like a dark blue Civic was worse. He tried his door, but the crushed roof of the car had wedged it shut. As a reflex, he pulled up the handbrake. He squiggled awkwardly over into the passenger seat, and that door opened with the same ease as it always did. He got out and stood up to observe the scene. There were but a dozen other cars gathered round. The drivers at the end of the line were blowing their horns, hoping that this meth they couldn't see would clear. The ones who were right behind him were outside of their own vehicles now, and a couple of them were already on their cell phones calling in the accident. A woman came over to George and asked him if he was all right. There was no sign of the driver of the Civic from this angle. His expedition was on top of it like a joke, a harmless, contrived collision at a demolition derby. But George had seen her eyes for half a second, and he knew that there was a woman there somewhere in the mess of all that metal and rubber and glass. A dead woman. "My wife," George said. The woman next to him looked over at him. She asked, letting her question trail off rather than make it specific. She thought he meant that his wife was in the Civic. "I need to call her. Can you call her? Do you have a cell phone I can borrow?" The woman looked at him confusedly. She looked down at the cell phone in her hand, but didn't offer it to him. She thought he must be delirious. She didn't know how to tell him that it looked like his wife was dead, or that if she wasn't, it was unlikely that she would be taking any calls. She chuckled briefly at the thought and then just handed him the phone. He pressed numbers, but got her voicemail. "Your call is being transferred to an automated voice answering system." He wanted to throw the phone away, wanted to run up and kick the Civic for being in his way and causing all that damage to his brand new SUV. "Karen, I'm in an accident here, down in the North End, in the Big Dig. It looks pretty serious. I'm okay, but the woman in the other car, it looks like she's dead. Oh, fuck, Karen. Oh, fuck." So perhaps I'll work backwards in this one from the end of what I just wrote and make my way to the front of it. So what I was very keen about at the end, where he's calling his wife and, telling her what's happened or wanting to tell her, is that I get the dialogue right. That is, I didn't want it to be, this is a very important thing, and it's something that a lot of people really ignore in their writing, is that the dialogue is just a little too pretty and perfect, and people don't talk like that. There's pauses and hesitations and repetitions. It's not efficient in a certain kind of way. And I really think it's important, sort of like in a play, it's very important to try to get that right. And you'll see the same thing in plays as well, where the dialogue just seems very stiff, and you could sort of, as I call it, you can smell the stink of the writer behind it or the playwright behind it. You can feel someone has written lines, and you can feel perhaps a poor actor reading those lines. So what I was trying to get at the end there, where he's just leaving a message on the cell phone, was just imagine it. A man has just, he's angry anyway. He's pissed off. He's just crushed a car and killed a woman. He's on the side. He's making a call to his wife. It's gone to voicemail, which was an intentional thing that I want to talk about as well. So he's leaving a message for his wife, Karen. "Karen, I'm in an accident here, down in the North End in the Big Dig. It looks like it's pretty serious. I'm okay, but the woman in the other car, it looks like she's dead. Oh, fuck, Karen. Oh, fuck." So It's very, you had to be very careful writing these things. Even as I just read that now, I frankly wonder a little bit if I overdid it with the "oh fucks" at the end. But you have to, I do like the fact that, you know, I'm okay, but the woman in the other car. And then he doesn't know how to finish that sentence. So he says, well, I don't think, I mean, what he wants to say is that I think I killed the woman in the other car, what he knows. And then there's a pause. And then he says, I mean, it looks like she's dead. So I was trying to get the rhythm of what he would say and trying to achieve all that rather than, you know, getting a message that would say, Karen, I'm in an accident down here. The SUV ended up on top of a car and a woman is dead, you know, that sort of thing. That's not going to work. That's not realistic. And as I mentioned, the deal about the voicemail, that is intentional as well. You know, it suggests that after the argument, she's either letting his calls go to voicemail, but even if it doesn't suggest that, it suggests that a certain, because in the argument that he's had with her, he's sort of lost, so to speak, and he's in a certain second class status in a kind of way. And so this thing about this just this brutal, very important thing has happened in his life, and he's relegated to having to go to goddamn voicemail in order to report it to his wife. So this was intentional as well, that he actually doesn't get to talk to her. And the other part, the part just before that, where the woman is standing on the side and he says, I need to call her. And the woman very confusedly thinks that the her he's talking about is the woman in the car. And so she has two reactions basically. And I wanted to record both of those. One is that, he must be delirious. As I say there, you know, what do you mean you want to call her? You know, what would be the point of that? And then the obvious is that she's probably dead. She's evidently dead, because if you can imagine a huge SUV on top of a Civic and crushing it, there's very little chance of any kind of survival. But I wanted to end with a kind of a duel here and a little bit of dark humor, where as the sentence says, she didn't know how to tell him that it looked like his wife was dead, or that if she wasn't, it was unlikely she would be taking any calls. That's in her mind. So that's what she's thinking. So what it suggests is someone with a dark sense of humor who chuckles briefly to herself as well. She, the woman, is probably in a state of confusion and shock and everything as well. So these crazy things can come to people when they're that. It's not, you know, everything is not logical in these sorts of things where, the woman will understand perfectly that, oh, of course you want to call your wife to report on this woman that you just killed in the car. And also the emotions are not logical. So the emotions, everything has the possibility of being funny, or everything has the possibility. I mean, technically speaking, as she might have interpreted it, he was asking if he could make a call to the woman in the car that was crushed there. So in a certain way, it's very logical for her to think, I don't think she's taking any calls. I mean, that's very, very dark humor, but it's something you could imagine a certain kind of personality or a certain kind of shock it going through your head, you know? So that's why I was very conscious of putting that there. So, and I wanted to make it clear earlier as well, the sentence is, but George had seen her eyes for half a second, and he knew that there was a woman there somewhere in the mess of all that metal and rubber and glass, a dead woman. So I just, this is where I wanted to put the point on two things. One is to establish the fact that she is dead, but also to establish the fact that he knows she's dead. He knows there's no one there that could have survived what he's just done in this giant vehicle of his. And this, the other part, the earlier part, again, I'm doing this backwards. I wanted to be careful about how I wrote this, the scene about, or the details about how the logistics of how it all happened. And what I was trying to do was to, again, try to think about how might it actually happen? And I wanted the language to reflect that. So I wanted the language to feel a little bit like it might have felt for him being in the cab at the wheel of the car, of the vehicle, of the SUV, and the decisions, both good and bad, that he might make. And again, realize that we're not talking about 5 minutes of luxurious time where you get to make a decision. These are seconds you're talking about. And so what a person might do. So again, keep that in mind as I reread the single sentence. And I'm trying to sort of, in a way, I'm trying to hit points in his mind kind of thing, and the reason he does what he does. He wasn't on the ramp for more than a couple of seconds when he saw the car coming right at him. In a rush of confused self-righteousness, continuing the pattern of a day in which he was always the person being wronged, he blew his horn, trying to get her out of the way, but it was all too late. Too late for him to turn away, too late for her to avoid the hit. And in a panic, he inadvertently hit the accelerator, surging ahead, his left headlight plowing through the driver's door window into her. And when things had stopped, when he could feel his vehicle no longer moving forward, he looked up and all he could see was a stretch of I-93. So the idea there is to, again, try to get the rhythm of how his thoughts might be, and also to indicate the kind of the ridiculousness of it. And this gets reflected later about, you know, the kind of the, it's very cartoonish in a way for a car to end up on, a vehicle to end up on top of another vehicle, the kind of thing literally you might see in cartoons, but you don't often. Often if there are car accidents, one rams into the other and the other is sort of thrown this way or that, depending on which one is bigger. But for one vehicle to actually end up on top of another is probably a rarer incident. And then the thing at the end I'm suggesting, where he looks up, I-93 is a section of the highway in Boston, or maybe the former highway. This was written at a time I referenced the Big Dig, which was a very large municipal construction project that they had in Boston so that they could put the highways underground. I used to live in Boston, and I haven't been there since the Big Dig has been finished, but that was the idea. So when he would look up at the time, after that, all he would see would be highway, because all the death and destruction would be below him. He cut himself shaving, and that little cut, a darker red fleck at the bottom of his chin, was still there as he meandered through the north end of Boston, looking for a way back home. So again, this is just a simple, clean foreshadowing. It's realistic in the sense that he's had an argument with his wife and he's in a rush. He's maybe a little bored too and sick of this whole thing. The whole idea of me saying he hauled himself through his own rituals. He may be tired of this whole life that he's leading with his wife. You know, that's what that's meant to suggest. Or, you know, to get a little less dramatic, he's just, doesn't want to do this today. You know, he just wants to stay in bed, haul yourself through rituals. You know, sometimes it can be, seem like a hardship to get up and have a shower and whatever. It reminds me of, and I don't know, this may be apocryphal, but someone told me, or I read somewhere years ago, that a suicide note was found in the 17th century or something like that. And the reason that the person gave for committing suicide, or at least what was written on the note, was all this buttoning and unbuttoning. And again, that's very, it seems to on point to be real in a way. But on the other hand, you think, back then you've got to unbutton, you know, there were more things were buttoned back then. It was before the age of the magical zipper. But again, the point here is that he's tired. You know, he doesn't want to be here. He doesn't want to be doing that. And he cuts himself shaving. So it's very realistic. But of course, the blood is a pre-shadowing of what's going to happen. And the other thing here, what they had argued about, I wanted to do a couple of things here. One was that they'd argued about sex. And your first thought about when men and women when a husband and wife are arguing about sex is that the husband wants more and the wife wants less, or the husband wants her to do certain things and she doesn't want to do those things. But it's the opposite here. So he's in a, again, I don't mean to suggest stereotypes and cliches and everything like that, but he's in a, again, I'm wanting to put him in a sort of a second class status where, you know, she's the one, he's not delivering, you know, he's not being a real man and all that. And then I wanted to, you know, they talk about sort of, it's very important in fiction and in writing generally, perhaps, to have just have a telling detail that sort of describes everything, you know. And the two details I pick here is that he commented on one of her blouses being too sheer. And the idea there that I wanted to get across is, again, a certain kind of jealousy or insecurity on his part, because maybe normally a husband would love the fact that his wife were wearing a sheer blouse and that he could see her breasts or the form of her breasts or see her bra, and that would be exciting. But he was arguing about that. And then his habit of leaving pizza crusts on the coffee table, perhaps that one is a little, I don't know, I don't want to be too critical, but that's a classic domestic issue that you can imagine between a husband and a wife, a husband who, you know, is watching football and eating pizza and drinking too much beer. And when he has the, when the game is over, he's had too much beer, so he has to go to the bathroom, and the crusts get left on the table. I mean, I'm reading a lot of kind of backstory into this, so to speak, but that's what I'm getting at here, a typical kind of domestic ongoing thing that would make for a less than ideal relationship. And that's it for the analysis of that. Again, I want to repeat that the purpose is always to not just pick out any old words, and the purpose is always to pick out the exact words that you think can convey something. And it's also important to pick out words in other scenes that, or sub scenes in other scenes, or small scenes apart from the main story or the main incident that's going on, that kind of reflect on it a little, or that complement it in a certain sort of way. That's very important, instead of just sort of, I've read fiction. Well, I actually haven't read much of it because I find I really can't tolerate it very well. But I read fiction, and the same thing, I'll go back. I know I make reference to movies a fair bit. You see the same thing in movies where the idea is just to get a story going along, and there's nothing special about it. There's nothing, in fact, you see them calling on a lot of movie cliches in order to do it. And you'll see a lot of it in writing as well, where the writing is just, you know, the person has a story in mind, and they're just, the writing is like the road on which they tell the story. And it doesn't matter whether it's paved or rocky or whatever it is, any old kind of thing that'll get you through. And that language that they use could be full of cliches and full of anything. And that's just not right. I mean, if you aspire to something that's more powerful writing, and for writing that really is sort of art, basically, you know, writing that sort of, I think of it as sort of folding in on itself, or everything seems of a piece, you know. So you have this story, you have this main incident going on here, of an SUV crashing into a car, but all of the other little things, they're not just indications of why this might happen, but they also have within themselves details that are sort of kind of reflect what happened or are mini versions of what happened or refer to in a sort of oblique way often what happened, so that, you know, everything is about the thing. That's the idea. There's no words that are wasted. There are no words that are unnecessary in the whole thing. And that's super important. So that's what I try to do. And that's what literary fiction tries to do. And that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again soon.